Igor Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring has become so much a part of the musical canon, it's difficult sometimes to understand just how angry people became at its premiere in 1913. Composer Camille Saint-Saëns walked out after hearing just the first notes, and soon other protests became so loud and the dancers could barely hear the cues. Fights broke out in the audience. Well, with me now to discuss Stravinsky, and we're hearing Stravinsky play right now, by the way, on a recorded piano roll. We're talking about Stravinsky and the marathon performances of his work that are taking place this weekend at Symphony Space. And we have here Symphony Space's artistic director, Isaiah Scheffer, and performer, composer, and educator, Beata Moon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Leonard.
Thank you.
I can understand that people might have been a bit shocked by its newness, but why did it create such a scandal, Beata?
I think maybe because they were not expecting this flood of the whole orchestra performing these chords that were just continuous, and you know, the sounds were dissonant to them for that time. And I think it was just a new language that they weren't accustomed to.
So. Well, was he really inventing a new language? I know he's been credited by some with creating two new approaches to music that then other people spent a lot more time with than he did.
Right. Well, he certainly elevated the use of rhythm in the music. So, and I think that influenced a lot of everyone, but also the American minimalists of today. And also, he would put two different chords together, bitonality or polytonality, which I don't think was common at the time. So it was just new to a lot of ears. So
he was thinking in a modular way. Instead of thinking symphonically with the whole orchestra being tied together, he would have a part here and a part there,
right? So
and
he would
bounce them off of each other.
Right. So in the use of form, he would add on different sections. That's right.
It's hard to imagine any piece of music getting that kind of reaction today.
Yeah. I mean, even in the opening of The Rite of Spring, his use of the bassoon was so uncharacteristic. Like, he really stretched that instrument. And nowadays, bassoonists can play it with no problem. But at the time, you know, it wasn't part of the technique at all.
It's what got Saint-Saëns so upset.
Right. We're doing something a little wild with that opening bassoon music.
Well, wasn't he declaring something to you, Isaiah, just by doing something that was so unusual?
Yes, that the old boundaries didn't apply anymore. And in fact, one of the things of our 12-hour day on Saturday is how few boundaries there are between many different kinds of music, from the Ebony Concerto, the jazz, to the early songs that Lucy Shelton was just recording a few minutes ago uptown at the theater. But with that opening bassoon, I wanted to say we have a jazz artist whom you know, Nora York, our wonderful singer, who with her brother Andrew Schwartz, the bassoon player, is doing what I call a riff on the rights. And she's actually got some Gershwin lyrics that fit that bassoon music. And that'll be followed by our belly dancer doing 3 minutes of stuff on The Chosen One from Rite of Spring.
So you're not just being pure Stravinsky, but there's
probably enough. Some liberties.
There's probably enough Stravinsky to fill 24, 36 hours.
There
or
is
more.
Plenty. And we had to choose, number one, what we could afford, and number two, who's around, who knows this or that piece, what's in the repertoire. Just now I left to run down here to WNYC a rehearsal of the Symphonies of Winds, which is a rarely heard ensemble piece. 23 of the best wind players in New York are there working with the conductor, Charles Neidich, to make that happen. That'll be special in the evening.
So you had to find musicians who just happen to be in town now and who could play Stravinsky.
Right.
Is Stravinsky still hard for musicians to play, Beata?
Well, as far as the piano music goes, they're certainly challenging, like the Petrushka and some of the two piano work. I think it's considered a difficult pieces.
Well, you teach. Do you ever have students?
Well, actually,
that's a good way to test the student,
right? But he also wrote pieces for the children, and that's the pieces that I'll be playing. And one of them is called The Five Fingers, and they're just short tunes, eight pieces based on like the five fingers. So the right hand is really playing the melody, and the left hand is doing various things. And it's really interesting. He's very creative and imaginative in how he accompanies and does different things with rhythm and harmony.
I understand that this will also mark the American debut of Fern Sydon, who'll be conducting The Rite of Spring.
Well, actually, that's a film she's made. She's made a film. She's a Swedish filmmaker, originally a New Yorker, but she's been living in Sweden. And she brought us this 26-minute film she did for Swedish television called The Rites of Spring, which explores marvelously, with animation that looks like Monty Python and with documentary, the pagan roots of what Rorik made into the libretto for The Rite of Spring. It's a terrific film, and we're screening it at 7 o'clock in the 12-hour marathon.
Is this is the first time you've ever devoted a marathon to Stravinsky.
It is.
But it's interesting that it follows a very successful one for Stephen Sondheim.
They couldn't be more different.
Where people lined up as early as 1:30. He is a lot more difficult. So do you expect the same kind of response?
Well, I don't think we'll have the Sondheim mania that we had last year. That was unique. I think we'll have a lot of Stravinsky fans. We're preparing for crowds. And, of course, Symphony Space members get priority admission. And it won't be on the radio simultaneously this year. We're recording it for future broadcast possibilities. So that might mean larger crowds. But it's hard to know. If it's a chilly, snowy day, that may cut into it.
And it's all free.
It's all free from Saturday morning at 11 till Saturday night at 11. And it's got, as I said, all kinds of variety, including a production of The Story of a Soldier, which is a real full-scale production with dance and with costumes. And Leonard Nimoy is playing the devil, and we're having a devil of a time getting all of that staged this afternoon.
And well, weren't you involved in translating Story of a Soldier?
Yes, I made a new English version of
rhymes and all?
Rhymes particularly. Havanas, you can't get them anymore, says the devil to the soldier when luring him to come and stay at his house. Yes, I was commissioned to do that by Channel 13 for a production a few years ago, and we've updated and tweaked it just a little bit. Richard Thomas plays the soldier, and Carmen de Lavallade has found a wonderful young dancer at Elliot Feld, who dances the Enchanted Princess's tango, waltz, and ragtime.
We're talking about Wall to Wall Stravinsky, a 12-hour marathon performance of the work of Igor Stravinsky, which will be at the Peter J. Sharp Theater at 2537 Broadway at 95th Street this coming Saturday from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. And although tickets are free, you should get in touch with Symphony Space. What, at symphonyspace.org?
Symphonyspace.org has all the details. You just show up, and if there are seats available, you can go to the table and get guest seats or
well,
go right
also,
in.
And they also can check it all out on our show page at WMYC.org. Beata, can you tell us a bit about Stravinsky's background and how he came to change so much over the years? How he came to this in the first place? His first work was quite different, wasn't it, when he was a student with Rimsky-Korsakov?
Right. He was born in Russia, and he studied with Rimsky-Korsakov. And actually, his father wanted him to study law, so it wasn't until he met Rimsky-Korsakov who encouraged him to go into music. And it just sounds like an exciting time. I mean, he, you know, his contemporaries were Debussy, Ravel, and also actually his work with Diaghilev, with the Russian ballet, inspired a lot of the famous works that we hear.
So what he did is he took this Russian sensibility that he got from growing up in Russia and hearing the music, and then Rimsky-Korsakov, and merged that with the French Impressionists?
I'm not sure if he merged it with the French Impressionists. He did incorporate a lot of Russian folk tunes in his music, and I just know that he was surrounded by a lot of different influences. So I didn't mean to say that.
History played a part. He was exiled from Russia and didn't go back until decades later. And so we've organized the Wall to Wall with a first quarter of his early Russian work, a second quarter of called In Exile in France, a third quarter called At Home in America.
Because he lived most of his life here.
Yeah, Hollywood and New York, and a fourth quarter that's called Stravinsky's Theater, which has things like The Story of a Soldier and Duo Concertante and the Ebony Concerto.
He is credited with really opening up music to modernism, and then later he becomes a neoclassicist. But he tries pretty much everything. Didn't he even try his hand at atonal music?
Yes, he did later on. Yeah, he was, at the same time that he was composing, Schoenberg was also exploring and working in his 12-tone. And actually, after, I think, Stravinsky heard a performance of Pierrot Lunaire in 1912, and he was influenced by Schoenberg a little bit, but he stayed away, and then he came back in his later years.
Well, I would have thought that he would have seen Schoenberg as a major rival, but he'd be open enough to even try his hand at 12-tone serialism is extraordinary. It suggests that he could rise above it. He was most interested in music.
In a film excerpt that we're showing from Richard Leacock's great film Portrait of Stravinsky, he says he has great respect for Schoenberg, but Webern is the one that he really loves of that school.
Because Webern had more of a melodic sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so they were actually the two different kinds of styles that musicians were, composers could either go either in the Schoenberg camp or the Stravinsky camp, and then later Stravinsky, I think with also the influence of Robert Kraft, explored more of the serial music.
Now, when you teach, do you find students open to this kind of music?
I think so. I mean, I think it just, I also work as a teaching artist through Lincoln Center Institute, so I also teach a lot of kids from, you know, the schools, and I find that a lot of kids are open. They just need someone to introduce it to them, and, you know, and also when they start composing themselves, if you encourage them, they start thinking in those ways, and yes, so.
But it is my sense, and maybe I'm wrong, Isaiah, maybe you have seen something different, that most of the young people who are interested in this kind of music are people who are interested in music, that there are dwindling audiences, younger audiences in general, for
I think that's true
popular music.
With the added factor of the ballet, so many people, myself included, came to Stravinsky by seeing the Balanchine creation, and one of the many themes running through our day is their collaboration. Arthur Mitchell and Jacques d'Amboise and Allegra Kent are going to talk about it, and Agon, one of his serial works. We didn't have the resources to put the full orchestral Agon on stage, but Bruce Saylor created a three-instrument version of it that will give people a chance to hear that side of Stravinsky.
And he really works well with dance because you almost see images when you just listen to the music. Was this something he was aware of, Beata?
I don't know if he was aware of it.
But he was composing for dance,
right,
in many cases, so he must have thought about how it would evoke dance.
Right. I think definitely, like with the Rite of Spring, a lot of the music, the rhythmic qualities were with the dancers in mind and trying to evoke the story, that primal of the earth opening, you know, and the rituals of the time. And
that Swedish film tells us about Valpurga. She was a pagan goddess of demonry and revelry, and she became Saint Valpurga, and the Walpurgisnacht is based on her, and it's still celebrated on April 30th in northern Scandinavia. People make bonfires to scare away the demons, and Stravinsky and Rorik got into that.
How do you pay for all of this, Isaiah? Because this is an extraordinary thing that you do. This one and all of the things that you do at Symphony Space, often going against all the conventional wisdom as how to run an arts festival and still survive.
Well, like all nonprofits, we try everything in finding funds, and you can read the list of people who have helped make Wall to Wall a success. This year, we're trying something a little different. It's free to the audience, and we maintain that it will be ever free, but we're also doing what the museums do and asking for a suggested donation and hope that people will take the suggestion, because it's very expensive to put together one of these. It costs a couple of $100,000, and you take in nothing at the box office.
And that's even if all the musicians are volunteering their work.
No, we actually pay all artists, and not big money, but honoraria, and when you have 200 people taking part in a day, it adds up. And just the logistics of running a 12-hour day and a week of rehearsals cost money.
How far in advance do you have to think of something like this? Is there another one already in the works that you're going to surprise us with somewhere down the line?
Yes. Next year's budget and program for Symphony Space is being set right now. It's going to the Finance Committee Thursday and the board for final approval. And we do have a wall-to-wall for a year from March. And do you want me to mention what it is now?
Of course.
The plan
I'm already reserving my seat.
Last year it was Sondheim. This year it's Stravinsky. And next year it's my hope that we can do, in collaboration with a number of small and large opera companies, wall-to-wall opera, surveying things from the early 17th century to something that's not written yet, but it will be written in Brooklyn Heights this year.
Wow. And Beata, you're going to be doing...
She'll be there.
Yeah, but on this one, you'll be doing some of the pieces that Stravinsky wrote for children?
Right. I'm playing some of his piano works, his short piano works. And I'm also accompanying some singers, Marnie Nixon, who is the voice of My Fair Lady and on West Side Story, and Lisa Flanagan, I'm sorry, a soprano, another lovely soprano. So.
And we're talking about Wall-to-Wall Stravinsky, the 12-hour marathon performance of the work of Igor Stravinsky throughout his life at the Peter J. Sharp Theater, 2537 Broadway at 95th Street. This coming Saturday, it'll be running from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. You have any final words before
Peter
we go
J. Sharp Theater is what we call the upstairs theater at Symphony Space, in case people get
confused.
That's
the big one.
That's right.
And the smaller one is the movie
theater. Leonard Nimoy Thalia, and Leonard himself will be performing in the theater, not named for him, upstairs this Saturday night.
Well, there's an awful lot of cross-cultural stuff that you do there on the Upper West Side. Thank you so much, Beata.
Oh, thank you.
And Isaiah.
Thanks so much, as ever, Lenny.
And here's Igor.